Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this seventh day of May. It is a Wednesday, and we thank you very much for being with us 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm Joe Donahue. We have a great panel. I'll introduce them to you in just a moment. I want to remind you, as we've been talking about over the last few days, that it is Listener Appreciation Week at WAMC, and yeah, we wouldn't be here without you. You know what a big part of this equation you are, and when you start putting all the numbers in and all the different quotients, is that what they are? I'm looking at Mark, who I think somehow knows math, and one of the very important ones is you all. And for what you do. And we are very excited. I don't know if you've heard any of these. We have this series of conversations where longtime listeners are telling us, and you, what the station means to them. And we'll hear one in about an hour. But I just want to remind you that it is Listener Appreciation Week. We love you. And look, this is all a way to get to our goal to make some money to keep this place afloat. As you know, we're under threat. We're concerned. A lot of people are. And people are asking us what they can do to help. Well, here you go. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. You can also go online, you can go online at WAMC.org. You can also call us at 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. But WAMC.org is the easiest way to do it. And, you know, the faster we make the money, the faster we have some peace and solace and know where we're at as all of the talk continues as to our funding, and we go from the front page of newspapers and websites and instead are able to just, you know, do our jobs. So wouldn't that be lovely? WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Let me introduce you to the group this morning. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, standing for Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Jim Henler is here. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Actually, it's a tough time to be a professor these days, but the next few days is our graduation, and seeing a whole bunch of smart young kids getting out into the world and going out there to change things is at least make some of the hassles that we're getting from the government worth it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Send them out and have them show us a lesson as to how it should be done. Like, let's go. Good for them. Yes, well, I have great hope. It's they're wonderful young people who are doing great things, and thanks to the wonderful professors and institutions who are around in our region and far beyond. We welcome the Executive Director of Communications for Local Power and former White House advance lead, Anna Markowitz, joins us. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's been a while. It's nice to see you.
Yeah. I'm going to be on twice this month, so
excellent.
I'm going to make up for lost time.
Go crazy.
All right.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, and thanks to Local Power for letting you take the morning off. That's very nice. Appreciate that. Investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, is here. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm good. I'm very grateful for the station on days like this. If you look around, if I may, just for a moment, you look around the landscape and you see the likes of 60 Minutes or the Washington Post or the LA Times and the pressures that bear on them, and you can argue that they seem to be responding to. I am very grateful there is an institution like public broadcasting and public radio, and specifically WAMC in this area, available. And I think current circumstances underscore its importance and value to everyone.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think, you know, so many people come up and say, what can we do? What can we do? And well, you know, making sure we're as financially secure as we possibly can be, as we are
most likely going to lose funding, some level, still to be determined, I think. And if anything else, even if that changes miraculously, then just a show of how important and how powerful and how much public radio means to people and public media all the way around. So, yes, thank you very much.
If I may, when someone asks me, I think there are two things that come to mind, the second of which is maybe particularly relevant to people who can listen to us when we're live at this hour. The first is always, I always tell someone, if you like public radio, make sure you tell your friends and family, because getting others to listen is the core of what this mission's about. Secondly, if the initials RMD make any sense to you, they didn't to me when my mother first called and said she had to take a required minimum distribution from her retirement account. If those make any sense to you and you are or are inclined to perhaps be a contributor to WAMC, I think the station has folks here who can help you contribute to the station in a very tax-efficient manner if you're facing required minimum distributions from some of your accounts.
It is. That's a great idea. Thank you.
And Joe, I would also
good banking
throw
tips.
In
yes.
that supporting public radio is really supporting public media in a very large way. And that's, you know, almost jokingly, everything from Sesame Street to, you know, Washington Week in Review and things like that across the entire thing, Morning Edition, things like that. I mean, the staying up with what's happening in the world is so important nowadays. It's part of why I enjoy being on this show. And, you know, it's a time where things are changing very fast, and public radio seems to be the right place to be for tracking that. And, of course, we're all doing our own advertisements here because we love this place.
Well, and that's the idea, that everyone who loves this place and has some meaning will find what they can do and do it, and that's all we ask. And, you know, I've used this as a pitch line for years and years, because it's true, which is that this station is very fragile. Most public radio, I mean, everything is fragile in some way. And public radio is very fragile. There's an on switch and there's an off switch. And we're coming to that point where we're as close to the on switch as we've been, or the off switch as we've been in a very, very long time. So whatever we can do to fortify and make sure that we have all the resources necessary, not only to keep the lights on, but also to fight, then that is very, very important. And we need you to do that. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Check the pull-down menu, and there are premiums and all kinds of different stuff that you can get. But if you just want to help us, that's great too. WAMC.org.
If I could, I find your message about the fragility interesting, because it is ironic. This station and public broadcasting broadly is not fragile and hasn't been with respect to its commitment to its listenership and its mission. And what it requires in order to sustain that is for members not to have a fragile outlook about the importance of that. And I really do believe in the listeners of this station and their support for that mission.
And you mentioned members, but it is easy, if you are not a member, to become a member by simply calling in, and whatever you can do, $1 or $5 or $10, and you're a member of this radio station. You can be a sustaining member. There's so many different things, so many different ways that you can do it. So I appreciate hearing from all of you this morning about the importance of this. And, of course, I appreciate from hearing from all the listeners as well, to help out in any way they can see fit. WAMC.org. Just know this is Listener Appreciation Week, but we appreciate you every day. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. All right, let's go to introduce everybody, right? Now we can go to the news of the day and get started on this Wednesday morning. India strikes Pakistan but is said to have lost jets. Officials and witnesses said at least two Indian aircraft had crashed after India struck Pakistani targets, escalating the conflict between these two nuclear powers. A concerning story, certainly. India said early Wednesday that it had conducted several airstrikes in Pakistan, hailing a victory in the name of vengeance for the terrorist attack that killed 26 civilians in Kashmir last month. But evidence was also growing that the Indian forces may have taken heavy losses during the operation. At least two aircraft were said to have gone down in India and the Indian-controlled side of Kashmir. That, according to three officials, local news reports, and accounts of witnesses who had seen the debris of two. The Indian government said its forces had struck nine sites in Pakistan and on Pakistan's side of the disputed Kashmir regime in what is described as retaliation for a terrorist attack that killed 26 civilians. Pakistani military officials said that more than 20 people had been killed, dozens injured after six places were hit on the Pakistani side of Kashmir and in the Punjab province. Residents of the Indian side said at least 10 people had been killed in shelling from the Pakistani side since India carried out its strikes. The two countries have fought repeated wars with the disputed area of Kashmir as a prime flashpoint since Pakistan was cleaved off from India in 1947 at the end of the British colonial rule in the subcontinent. So, tensions in India and Pakistan that come to a violent peak as of this morning. Mark.
Joe, going into this, it was broadly expected that India would retaliate for the terrorist attack in Kashmir in a meaningful military way. And there are fears. Obviously, Narendra Modi is a nationalist and has whipped up a lot of nationalism with India, and he needs to serve them some red meat in the wake of the terrorist attack. And so, too, on the Pakistani side, the General Munawar, I think is how you pronounce his name. I've only ever read it. I haven't heard it recently. He's really the one that runs the country, as is normally the case in Pakistan. And he is seen as a hardliner, not afraid to use military force. So the hope here, the fear is that these two guys go at it in a way that continues to escalate. But I think in the wake of this attack, there's broad hope for a number of reasons. Number one, India seemed to have launched the attack from at least its side of disputed territory. It seems to have done so in a very specific way, and the rhetoric that follows suggests that they're largely done with the military retaliation. On the Pakistani side, there are a few things to note. First of all, they've claimed they've downed five jets. And if you're India, you probably want them to claim that they've downed 20 jets so right. That they can serve that meat to their populace. Additionally, the number of casualties initially reported by the Pakistanis were 26, which is probably not an accidental number because that's the exact number of people who were killed in the terrorist attack in Kashmir. There is a little bit of concern that the United States, which normally plays a role of encouraging moderation, may not take that as seriously as it used to. Frankly, in the Henry Kissinger days, you can imagine Henry Kissinger calling the general in Pakistan and saying, you know, the Indians don't want the following sites to be attacked, but there are eight tanks lined up in this military base that isn't used this time of year, and it would make for great photographs if you hit that. So hopefully the United States is giving Pakistan some guidance, frankly, as to a response that they will see as adequate to serve the desires of the Pakistani population, but allow things to calm down once the Pakistanis have fired.
Anna?
I'm concerned. I feel like I see a lot of similarities between what's going on in Gaza and the Pakistani issue. You know, there's a divide in religion, which is always an issue with things like this. And, you know, I worry, similar to what Mark said, that without a feeling of intervening from the United States, that this could escalate. I really hope that it doesn't. I hope that they are watching what's going on in Gaza and say, we don't want to have something like that happening here. But it has a very similar history of combat over decades. And right now does seem to be an inflection point.
Jim?
Yeah, you know, so for many years, one of the worries in the U.S. Defense Department was where you could have the possibility of an accidental or it's not quite the right word, but a nuclear event occur without full without going through all of the rigmarole that normally would go on. So in the U.S., to launch something nuclear takes significant numbers of people doing very specific actions. There are many protections built in, much less so in some of the smaller nuclear nations. And India, Pakistan has always been one that people are scared of getting out of control. I don't think this particular incident looks yet like it could get there, but I think, building on what Anna said, that's where our fear should be. And what really worries me is the current government has basically said, we don't really care very much about foreign relations except with a few countries where we see important ways we can make money off of them. Very transactional. And that scares me because it's, you know, I'm not sure I'd go quite as far as calling up and saying where the tanks are, but we've always played this diplomatic role of trying to make sure through the Defense Department that we would try to keep things under control. And I do worry that
I have to pause you
that
there.
We don't have a Defense Department right now that's functional.
We'll take a right back.
Org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are discussing India and Pakistan. I do want to say that right now on the monitor on CNN, they're showing this just incredibly long line for people in Chicago to get real ID. And I will ask the panel, but my understanding on real ID is if you have a passport, you do not need real ID if you're going to travel. Is that true?
You just need to bring your passport with you for an international flight or for a domestic flight, whereas before you wouldn't have to.
Right. So if you have that, you're still covered.
Yeah.
Yes.
You just have to remember to bring it on, you know.
Oh, yeah.
June 1st when you go to Europe or whatever fabulous place you're going.
I would just say, I'm going to give it a political angle. That line in Chicago and wherever else they are, realize they're on the last few days before real ID is being required, and it's taken us at least a decade. So when I hear this nonsense about, oh, it's going to be easy if we require voter ID, just stop with that and take a look out your window.
Yeah, that's a great that's a great point. And Pam Bondi yesterday said, look, if you don't have one, you'll still probably get to go through, probably. But
that seems a little risky when you have a flight to catch.
That's right.
Oh, no, the better.
We'll put you in a different line and ask you a few more questions. That was the answer. Yes.
Yeah, but probably go through. It's like, okay, so you get to fly from here to Tacoma, and then you get to Tacoma and probably turns into no. And then what do you
I know. That's a great point. It's an excellent, excellent point. All right. So back to the
Tacoma. Sorry.
I love Tacoma. What a great city.
So do I, but
it's a far flight. I will say that. I will say that getting back from Tacoma is a pain.
I have to say what's interesting at the moment is I am looking at a potential European trip and watching everything that's going on in the U.S. in terms of air safety and My wife is like, why don't you just stay home?
So, yeah, well, let's not talk about that. I got a vacation coming up, anyway. And I'm leaving, and I don't want to screw it up.
Can I back? First of all, I should see if Jim was done. But
yes, you got it in under the wire there, Jim. But was there anything else you wanted to add?
No.
Okay, that's
so
good.
I want to dovetail with something that Anna said about Gaza. And I read a article in The Economist a few weeks ago that highlighted the fact that in most of the conflagrations where Israel ended up going into Gaza and or Lebanon, the United States is the party that told them when to stop. And unfortunately, this time around, the Trump administration is not telling them when to stop. Mm-hmm. And I, in my personal belief, any reasonable read of the way they're treating the Gazans in terms of starving them to death, or now contemplating an ongoing occupation, shows that the United States can not only help, if you will, the aggrieved party, but it can also help the actor, because I think there are very obvious arguments as to why what Israel's doing isn't even in its long-term interest and may well be influenced by BBICU and some of his political concerns. I think in the case of India, Pakistan, just to bring it back, I think the lift here seems reasonable enough that even as Donald Trump calls him Little Marco, can figure this out and we can sort of bring that imbroglio to a simmer pretty quickly. But let's hope the administration is capable of this, and let's all spare a moment for those that are dying in Gaza, because the administration isn't capable of that one.
So as we go to India and Pakistan, what do you believe they need to do to be, and at very least, capable?
Oh, I in a way, I wasn't joking when I said Rubio should call up Pakistan. And I assume something like this happens where you say, look, there are 8 tanks that the Indians typically use for target practice sitting out in a field in a military base. Go ahead and blow them up and declare victory and let's get out of this. I do think that the Pakistan has to fire off a kinetic response, and I hope they're getting guidance, because unfortunately, whereas in India's case they can hit these jihadist bases, there isn't an equivalent in India, so they're going to have to hit military sites. And you want to do it in a way that the Indians can say, well, nah, 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 you didn't hurt us. And the Pakistanis can tell their population, boy, we showed them and it's all done.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope you're right, because remember, you have significant nationalists on both sides now. The governments in both places are not moderate governments. You know, I don't want to get into the Gaza situation parallels. I'm not happy, obviously, with what's going on there on either side. But the key change was, as Hamas got more powerful and their ideologues, their hardliners, and Israel's hardliners, you know, what grew out of many small clashes became a huge clash, which then grew into a full-scale war.
And
that's what scares me. And in the Pakistan is how easily these things can get out of control when you have people on both sides who care more about, one, themselves, and two, their, you know, hardline beliefs, than people who are, you know, really trying to run a government and keep a country functioning.
And hopefully the U.S. doesn't step on the scale like they did in the Gaza-Israel situation when Netanyahu came and met with Trump, and Trump essentially said, I would just clear out everybody and turn it into a Gazan resort. So I think that kind of gave Netanyahu a bit more leeway to do what he wanted. Whereas hopefully in the Pakistan-India situation, Marco Rubio is being more balanced and encouraging them to de-escalate, I would hope.
I hope we have some evidence or get some evidence that Rubio is even saying anything or calling anyone. I actually am not totally convinced, because typically the State Department will get some of that information from the Department of Defense. Currently, our Department of Defense is in such disarray at the top that it's hard to believe they'd even know about those 8 tanks hanging out there. And our intelligence community has been stripped of capability at an incredible level. Again, I'm not going to go on and on this. You've heard me and Malia go head-to-head on or agree with each other on just how bad things are getting, and we've both been very involved in that over the years. And so, you know, I hope you're right. I hope the U.S. will try to moderate this, but frankly, I'm not sure that we'll do anything more than stay out of it and say it doesn't really concern us very much. And that'll either let things get out of hand or let some of the countries we've been concerned about in the past provide more influence in the region, something that was not in our best interest in the long term.
We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'd love to hear from you on this subject and the other subjects that we'll discuss this morning. panel@wamc.org. Mark.
Oh, I was just going to relay a story of statecraft that relates to this situation that I thought very interesting. If you remember, Iran sent all those missiles and drones at Israel, and Israel had to respond. Israel very selectively took out some of the most sophisticated air defense systems that Iran had, and sent a very clear message: we can hit you whenever we want, so be careful. The Iranians doctored photos of the sites and made it basically took pictures of other missile defense batteries and published these, particularly internally, and basically said, oh, the Israelis missed, knowing full well they didn't, but it allowed both sides to climb down. You hope that there's something like this that's in the works between Pakistan and India.
And we shall see over the next several days and weeks. But to all of your points, there's a lot internationally going on, a lot of balls in the air that are being juggled.
Suddenly we're friendly with we're no longer at odds with the Houthis. We've come up with there was a claim that some kind of ceasefire has been declared. I suspect that the Houthis, having dropped a bomb that almost hit Israel's main airport, is not something that's going to calm the situation in the area. And, you know, again, there's just a lot of flashpoints in the world right now. And there was always the assumption that any major war would start among the major powers. And now what we're starting to see is the possibility of a lot of these smaller things breaking out and spreading. And, you know, I suspect that the people who are wargaming things in the Pentagon, assuming they're still being allowed to do so, are looking at very different kinds of challenges than they did some years ago when it was always major power on major power. I certainly hope so.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Jim Handler, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman make up our group this morning, and we'd love to hear from you. panel@wamc.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday morning. And let's go to another topic, and we'll hear from you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, as far as India and Pakistan. Not a great letter generator, just for what it's worth. I will add that to the equation. Okay, so let's now talk about some other things going on, and the Oh, we were just speaking about this a moment ago, about all that is happening internationally, and it is there is much to discuss, and we'll do our best to try to get to as much of it as we possibly can. I'm not going to go into it right now. We'll talk about it some more at a later date, but obviously the conclave is going on in Rome, and to elect a new pope, voting is expected to take place, I think, in a few hours. There will be two votes and today, and we'll see what happens. So jury's still out on that, as it were. But what I want to talk about is the Trump administration planning to send migrants to Libya on military flights. This is sort of a tag team story, I think, but the nationalities of the migrants were not immediately clear, but a flight to Libya carrying them could leave as soon as today, according to officials. This is sending people out of this country to other countries and for deportation, and the most recent place seems to be Libya. A flight to Libya carrying the migrants could leave today. Human rights groups have decried the conditions in Libya's migrant detention centers as deplorable. Meanwhile, we also learned through reporting in the Washington Post that this had been going on during the negotiations following the quote-unquote disastrous meeting in the Oval Office between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump, that they're also in the negotiations is that they would also like to send migrants and immigrants to Ukraine as well. So this, I think you take these two stories, you put them together, and you have obviously increased efforts of where to put people that the administration does not want in this country, and then where to send them.
I mean, I find this despicable, to be removing people with no due process off the streets to foreign countries is a thing of dystopian novels. They're currently already experiencing huge issues and pushback with sending migrants to El Salvador. The New York Times, tons of outlets have said that up to 75% of the people who were deported there don't have any criminal records. So this whole "we're only sending the worst of the worst" seems to be a falsehood. So I don't think that we should be increasing these efforts and diversifying our countries. I think that we should be putting the brakes on this terrible policy and allowing people to have due process.
Jim?
Hear, hear. And, you know, what I think is interesting is the Libyan response to this, which has been, what the heck are they talking about? That's not the exact words. The exact words are that Libya has denied that there has been any discussion, says, I believe, it violates the sovereignty of our homeland. So, you know, we are not seeing Libya say, oh, yeah, we really want to take in U.S. Folks. So, you know, there are a lot of people who think maybe this is just yet another threat to keep people scared. So Trump can look tough, things can move, and people stop counting numbers, because if you actually look at the number of deportations versus the number of people Trump said would be deported, they're nowhere close. But when you have these big headline, you know, we're going to send them to Libya, we're going to send them to Ukraine, active war zones, I mean, is about as crazy as I can imagine, and clearly is performative much more than real.
I think it's performative at two levels. One, for Trump's base, but I also think the current administration is trying to make its job easier by striking fear into the hearts of would-be immigrants into this country, particularly would-be irregular immigrants. Also, with respect to sending people to Libya or to El Salvadorian maximum security facilities, where's the Eighth Amendment in all this? I mean, I have not heard if once we send you to El Salvador and you've never been convicted of a crime, when do you get out? When are you eligible for parole? I have not heard any explanation of that. And if you're not, and you're we're doing this as the United States, even though we're sending them sort of across a border, I don't think most Americans would agree that that then ends our obligation to treat people in line with our Constitution or even humanely. And I have not heard any explanation for it. Let's say you were an irregular immigrant into the United States and you shouldn't have been and you got deported. How long do you stay in the El Salvadoran maximum security facility for? I'm a little surprised the courts aren't being more aggressive about that element of this and about stopping the administration.
Well, I mean, El Salvador touts themselves that the only way out is in a coffin. So that's a disconcerting answer.
But even if that's the case, I haven't even heard how long are we paying El Salvador? So let's say there's a 19-year or 18-year-old down there who theoretically is going to last another 80 years. What's the contract between the United States and El Salvador read as to how we compensate for that? And if there isn't one, what's the non-written version of that contract that we've discussed with El Salvador? There's so much we don't know that's being done in our name that seems so cruel. It needs to stop.
Yeah, and I'd like to say, you know, I understand the discouraging of people crossing the border illegally. I'm not sure this is the way I would do it, but it certainly, there have been a lot of weird things they've done in extending military bases so that anybody touching our, instead of building a wall, we just called it a military base, and now suddenly you can get arrested the minute you touch
the
soil.
Right.
But you know, we were talking about throwing red meat to your populace. And that's what this is really doing, is Trump is throwing red meat to his base. The polling on the treatment of immigrants is really staggeringly different between hardcore Republicans, what you might, you know, independents, and people who describe themselves as conservative former Republicans. And then on the other side, Democrats and progressives, it's staggeringly different. And, you know, it really, I think, also highlights the differences in the media coverage, the differences in discussions of what's going on, the numbers reported change from day to day. And I think you're right, Mark, there's no exit. But meanwhile, we have a lot of people who are in this country. They were on a path to being allowed to be here legitimately, which suddenly got turned off first by president, then by Congress, then not turned on again in a split Congress, et cetera, et cetera. We almost had a deal that would have dealt with a lot of this under the Biden administration, but Trump wanted to run on the issue, so he got that killed. They're making it almost impossible to make it safe, regardless of your immigration status, regardless of, you know, again, illegal immigrants sounds like a scary thing. Our country has been very dependent on a lot of that. We used to allow much of that to happen legally. But, you know, trying to deal with what this would do to the U.S. And, you know, you look at again, I said this the other day, the traps they're setting up. So if you show up at your mandated hearing, then you get arrested. And if you don't show up at your mandated hearing, you're now a lawbreaker who can be deported. And just the lack of rationality in the whole thing, the lack of actually trying to solve a problem rather than make the problem look bad, just, again, just is crazy.
And the humanity, I mean, the of where we're sending them, that we hear of the conditions of this facility in Libya. We've obviously heard of the other conditions at the other facilities, that does not seem to be taken into any consideration as these deals, quote unquote, are being worked through as to where people are going to go.
I mean, I think that's a feature, not a bug for them, because it's a scare tactic. And I think that it's not an accident that this is happening right before they roll out a program of self-deportation, saying, hey, are you scared yet? How about we give you $1,000 and an air flight back home, and maybe you won't end up in El Salvador. What a bonus.
Or Libya.
Or Libya.
Or Ukraine.
So, you know, it's despicable, but I think that there is a strategy. It's just not a strategy I condone.
I remember when the conservatives were trying to do this in the UK and sending people to Rwanda, and how just morally bankrupt I thought that was. And now my own country is contemplating or on the verge of doing this. It's sad.
It is sad. And actually, I was reading an article in the Times about exactly about that, of the lessons for Trump from Britain's failed Rwanda deportation deal. And because the U.S. is said to be in talks with the African country about taking in expelled immigrants. And the foreign minister of Rwanda said that his country was in early stage talks with the Trump administration. That news had a familiar ring in Britain, where the former conservative-led government agreed to a deal in 2022 to permanently deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, then spent 2 years and hundreds of millions of pounds trying largely fruitlessly to make the plan happen. When Britain's highest court ruled that the proposal broke human rights laws, the conservative government tried to use new legislation to override the judgment. But in the end, the policy proved an almost complete failure, and the new Labour government, which was elected last year, scrapped it, citing huge expense and unworkability. So exactly to your point of, yes, you look at that in horror, and then right now there's people in the administration going, oh, that may work.
Yeah, and I look at the clock, and I, you know, I don't want to be crass about this, but I think if the comment there about the millions of dollars that the UK spent and got nothing done effectively, and the amount of money that this administration is spending, it's not even clear if you look in retrospect that DOGE saved money given all the severance they've had to pay and all the hires and rehires. And you got to imagine that the way Trump is approaching this has got to be far more expensive than it's worth, not to be crass, but just what a bunch of fools those people are.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this.
This is WAMC CEO Sarah Gilbert. It's a pivotal time for public media, as you know, and we're using this opportunity to hear from members of our loyal, lovely audience about why they value our work, in their own words. Here's Aaron Shello-Levine.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm here with two listeners who came to the area within the past year or so and have sort of found a home, at least on our airwaves, with WAMC. I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Brielle Farmer. I am a photographer and yoga teacher, and I moved here about a year and a half ago.
And I'm Brielle's husband. My name is Harrison Schmidt. I'm an assistant professor of psychology at Skidmore College. I also moved here in 2023.
So when did you guys discover WAMC? I know it's sort of the local public radio station. Have you guys always been public radio people?
Yeah, I think we've always been public radio people, kind of like stereotypical NPR folk. So I was excited, I think about a year and a half ago, I started listening to WAMC. I was excited to just kind of find a local NPR chapter that really covered local issues and just felt familiar in that kind of way.
Do I listen to local radio? No, but I like this channel a lot. Like, I feel like I'm learning a lot about the local community because I just moved here, and I feel plugged in.
Thank you so much for listening and for being part of our community. You can keep it all going with a pledge at WAMC.org.
Public radio people, you just heard from two of them, and we know that there are many more out there that we would love to hear from, and we'd love to hear from you.
WAMC.org to support it, to keep it strong, to keep donating. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. Every story that we do, you make possible simply by helping us, and we hope you continue that. WAMC.org. It's Listener Appreciation Week, and we have an opportunity to hear from listeners, and we also want to hear from you. WAMC.org. WAMC.org. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a great group this morning. Let me reintroduce them to you. Jim Hendler is here, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. And Anna Markowitz, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House, I screwed it up last time, and former White House Advance Lead, Anna Markowitz. Good morning. Very nice to have you here. And sorry, I messed up the first one. I'm going to give them their due. Investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman, is here as well. Thank you all for joining us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so we have letters on what we were just talking about in the case of deportation and immigration in this country. Jill said, yesterday, ICE came to our small town of Great Barrington. It was bone-chilling to see. People are being taken away by masked, unidentified individuals with only police marked on their backs. Many people were there, but no one knew what to do. Despite the demand by onlookers for warrants, there was no actionable plan. No one knew what to do. How do we handle such things as resistors?
It's a good question. And, you know, there are some good examples, but the problem is you have to know some of the potential targets. So the best example is in Connecticut, where ICE moved in on the protest. Or they wanted to deport. He, knowing that it was possible, already had a whole network set up and literally just, you know, within 15, 20 minutes, there were people out on the street to film things. Attorneys were being called and they kept, and before they could get him out of Connecticut and into some prison somewhere, they were able to put a hold on things. I think communities have to start creating those kind of networks at a level without knowing who the individuals are. Just say, if you see this happening, call this number, do this. And, you know, we on almost every college campus I know now is starting to have these discussions. What do we do? We have, you know, sort of we know who to call, but now it's starting to move to having things posted in classrooms that say, here's the steps to take. You don't have to remember right. In a crisis what to do. Here's exactly who to call and how to call them.
It's just hard when, you know, you can have all of the how-to documents and guides you want, but if the ICE agents aren't following proper protocol, what do you do? There was a couple who had ICE. They were locked in their car. ICE was yelling someone else's name, not the person in the car's name. They called their lawyer like they were supposed to. They said, we're going to wait in this car until the lawyer comes and we'll come out then. ICE started breaking into their car with a sledgehammer. You know, so that's not in the rule books. That's not on the documents of what to do. So it just seems like the game is constantly evolving in a way that it's very hard for people to prep for. I mean, and I do think that we should be filming as much as we can, documenting as much as we can, knowing our rights to ask for a warrant. But, like, what do you do when someone's bashing your car with a hammer? You know, it's rough.
I'll tell you a chilling story I heard. I have a family friend who's a bus monitor. They're going through training. They've been told that if somebody stops their bus and approaches the children are not to respond. No one has to touch the children. and they need to call the bus company's lawyers. You just think about the unnecessary fear that what's going on has put into this country. And let's not forget the headline here. Donald Trump is not successfully deporting any more people, or his rate of deportation is not any higher than it was during the Biden administration. Right. And it's probably lower than it was during the Obama administration, although we can argue about how happy we were or were not about that time frame.
Number.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, I think the blurring of lines that are going on now between, quote, illegal immigrants who, quote, have broken a law. And by the way, the list of laws that used to be enforced were primarily felonies. Now it's all the way down to things like traffic tickets. But then you move to green card holders, and then you move to citizens. And we're really talking now about, Trump is literally talking about sending U.S. citizens convicted of crimes, but to these horrible prisons in El Salvador and things like that. This the same Trump who 4 years ago was 8 years ago was bragging about prison reform, because there had been a move on the part of his base that, you know, people were throwing and being thrown in prison in ways they shouldn't be, that things were too harsh, et cetera, et cetera. Now all of a sudden it's like, let's rebuild Alcatraz. People keep calling it performative. The problem is it's scary performative, right? It's, I wish I knew what to say other than, it scares me. And I didn't come into this scared. I came into this country is resilient. This country has a constitution that was built to make this stuff not happen. My wife, who is far more progressive than I is, they're going to ignore all that. They're going to break laws. They're going to do horrible things. And I have to admit, now she's right. And I don't know where our resilience is going to come from. At the moment, it's the courts. And that's going to eventually move to the Supreme Court. And we've already seen the Trump administration trying, you know, working around, that got a 9-0 decision against them and still hasn't moved on it. They've just made noises about moving on it. So now what happens the first time the Supreme Court really tries to turn off something Trump cares about? I think he's betting on his court backing him, but I think there's lines even this Supreme Court won't go over. And it scares the hell out of me what happens when that happens.
We have more letters from listeners. This one from Erica. A couple of things on this. First, in case the public doesn't know, American prisons for its own citizens are just as deplorable as these detention centers and foreign gulags. Torture, neglect, and negligence is part of the operating manual. Second, when societies decided who is deemed a second-class citizen, they stopped caring about how these people are treated. Third, we have now decided in America that all crimes are capital crimes, punishable by life in prison and then ultimately the death penalty. No matter what you believe or what you know or don't know about the law, every person on American soil has the right to face their accuser. Stop saying due process. You are free because of the rule of law. That from Erica.
And, you know, I've said this before. I think if you stop most Americans and said, what is due process, you wouldn't get very good answers. But I think if you stop most Americans and said, how important is due process, they would say very. And I think getting some of that education of what it really means and why it's so important to more people is important. And we've had that conversation on the show before, so I won't go there again. But, you know, it really is important that people understand due process isn't, you've got 12 hours to try to reach a lawyer, and by the way, the courts are closed, right? Due process is well-defined. What are the processes? It's a deliberative process that makes things very carefully done, and it's aimed at preventing exactly the kind of mistake that sends a U.S. citizen to El Salvador, even though that's totally against every U.S. law and policy we have.
We get this letter from Linda, who says, we already incarcerate more people than any other developed country, so now we want to jail people in other countries. How about we fix the systemic problems in the U.S. that result in so much criminal activity or alleged criminal activity? Then we go to Robert. If the U.S. sends people to other countries and putting them in prison/jail, is it really a deportation? I thought deportation was you send them to other countries, but they are not held in jail there, but are free in that country.
Well said.
There's that point. And then we go to, is that it? I must have deleted one because I knew I had three and then I only had two. So I apologize. I'll try to find it and we'll go back to it. Moving on to other stories this morning as we talk about different things. Jim's here, so I wanted to talk a little bit about AI hallucinations. I thought this article was fascinating. It's an article in the New York Times, and it's a new way of reasoning systems from companies like OpenAI that is producing incorrect information more often. And the question is, these quote-unquote hallucinations are getting worse even as the systems and the technology becomes better and more powerful. So how would you define, let's start with this, Jim, how would you define an AI hallucination?
So essentially, it's pretty simple. It says something that sounds factual, but it's just plain wrong. So for example, it won't do this anymore, but a couple years ago, if you asked ChatGPT, what awards has Professor Jim Hendler won? It would give you a list of which... I really loved that list. I just wish I had won some of those awards. Now, if you were trying to decide to hire someone or it's like that, and you get this thing that's saying, you know, they're far more famous than they really are or things like that, that impacts a decision. But they can also be, you know, far more subtle. There were the law cases that didn't exist. Nowadays, it's things like, the law case did exist, but maybe the system has not quite said what the decision was correctly. Or, you know, we've seen a lot of cases. We're working on a project at RPI where you get the response, you tie it to known knowledge, and then you see where it has gotten things that you can validate versus which things either you can't or you can prove are wrong. And it's really staggering how often it's wrong in subtle ways, where it used to be wrong in very, very specific ways. So hallucinations are essentially, I'm trusting that the AI has generated a correct answer, and I'm discovering that it wasn't correct. Or maybe I'm not discovering. It wasn't correct. And that's the definition we use. They can get much more subtle in some ways, they can be more complex in other ways. There's a lot of research in how to make things better. There's a lot of research showing why things are getting worse. And this article that says the hallucinations are getting worse is really something that's starting to, not surprisingly, concern the AI companies, because if people start using them but can't trust them, and especially if you start using them in day-to-day things. So built into your mailer is something that says, you answer this mail, right? Well, think of that like your autocorrect, where sometimes you look at the message you just sent and said, oh, no, it fixed that last word differently than I would have, and it wasn't the word I wanted. It was something completely different, and there's whole pages to go see embarrassing autocorrect errors their whole page is to go see embarrassing AI hallucinations too, and it's almost like a war between the people who are trying to make it better and the companies that are trying to get these things out, who don't want them to be giving wrong information, but are having more and more trouble finding things to feed them that are correct, partly because a lot of what's being generated out there that these companies can then feed to their systems has been generated by AI, or even worse, when it's a human and an AI together. And it can be shown that when you give an AI output of a different AI or even its own AI to train on, its performance gets worse and worse. So a lot of what they believe is happening now is we're starting to see harder and harder to tell what was AI generated, what was human generated. Therefore, what's feeding into these systems is more and more AI generated. There was actually a really interesting article just recently. Zuckerberg gave a talk in India, and he was talking about how people are starting to use AI as their friends. They're saying, you know, here's something I can't discuss with my family or my parents, so let me, you know, go to these AI systems on Meta or on Google or whatever and ask some of these things, which of course means you're sharing these things. But it turns out
that's what dogs were for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it actually turns out
imaginary friends.
Yeah. Well, it actually turns out that now there are AI accounts that are starting to make friends with other AI accounts who are then generating ads that these companies are paying. So there's a very interesting economic thing going on where people are beginning to believe that we may get to a point where the AIs are talking to the AIs that are deciding who to sell things to are focusing on them, and us humans could go back to actually interacting with each other like normal people. But that's kind of a utopian view.
One of the things that struck me about this particular article, and you touched on it, but I'm interested in the thought about the systems becoming more powerful, which to me would mean then the issues can be bigger and more problematic. Is that a correct rule of thumb?
Yes, but powerful in two ways, right? One is it's generating something that I'm going to use to make a business decision or something like that, and I want it to be correct. And this is important because I'm getting ready, you know, we're getting ready to do $1 million investment in some company, and, you know, we've used the AI to help us do some of the background, and guess what? It got some of the numbers wrong that might really have changed our decision. But it's also becoming more powerful in, let me call it, low-level pervasiveness, right? I won't do this, Joe, but, you know, I'm almost tempted sometimes for other radio shows that are calling shows to generate an AI that will just send message after message after message to, you know, some of these right-wing radio hosts saying, what about this? What about this? What about this? And, you know, it's getting easier and easier to do that. So, again, when you're using the AI to do just a common day chore and it makes a mistake, buy me the cheapest one of these you can find. Guess what? It just paid $10 more for something than if you had been able to go looking yourself. And people are starting to trust these things. So power comes in a lot of different ways here. And we have very little policy, regulation, et cetera. There was a big move to increase that during the Biden administration. The Trump administration started with an executive order that has essentially said anything that makes it harder for U.S. AI companies to flourish including regulation, et cetera, is now off the books. Get rid of that stuff. We want to be the world's leader in AI, and we do that not by controlling the AI, but by letting Elon Musk and others do whatever they want with their systems. And that's what makes this, to me, much more scary.
I think that the trust is the main crux here. I've used it a little bit. I'm one of those novices that you speak of, where I just put into ChatGPT, oh, what do you think the answer is to this? And sometimes it'll just give me a blatantly wrong answer. And if I wasn't a critical thinker, if I was just like, oh, okay, sure, ChatGPT says this, I would have a wrong answer and be making poor decisions. I think that for people who are maybe older and more accustomed to not using AI for most of their life and most of their decision making, it might be more instinctive to question it and say, hey, should I say, like, I've told ChatGPT, like, that's wrong. And they'll be like, oh, yep, you're right, that is wrong.
Sorry.
But I think that for younger people who are going to grow up using this, I hope that they continue to have that second guessing and ability to think independently, because otherwise it could be detrimental.
Well, but think of something different than ChatGPT, right? You go to Google, and now when you put in your search query, first thing you get is this long answer from Meta AI, mm-hmm. right? Many of us in the AI community have learned to scroll past that and go look for the web search pages that we mm-hmm. originally used to look for. But if you're a regular person, Google's a very trusted company. They've done a very good job of doing things. Now suddenly you're getting this generated thing, and you know, if there's mistakes in it, you're not looking further. You're not doing things. You got your answer.
And what if it's a doctor? Like, a lot of doctors are using AI to, you know, help them to diagnose things. What if they're making errors based on that, you know,
right.
becomes life
and
death?
And worse, people are avoiding doctors. So I go to Google now, and I say, you know, does this drug interact with that drug? Mm-hmm. Right, because I'd been prescribed a couple drugs, right? Used to take me to medical pages. Now it generates an answer that may or may not be correct. And it tries to back it up with sources, but they're not always correct. It's not always pointing at the correct place to look. And again, I won't go as geeky as I'd like to on this, because I teach an entire course on this stuff. But it's really scary what goes on when people start to trust the AI.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jim Hendler, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman making up the group. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So, yesterday, we found out that Canada is not for sale.
What?
Yes, it is not. They have not put it up on the market yet. If you track Zillow, Canada not there.
Maybe next season?
Yeah, maybe. I think they're just, you know, going to Airbnb it for a little while and see what happens. I don't. Carney, and I'm using a headline here, so let me use the correct title. Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada, the newly elected leader, met with President Trump yesterday and then went back and forth on the prospect of the U.S. making Canada the 51st state. Carney telling Trump that Canada is not for sale. As you know from real estate, there are some places that are not for sale, Mr. Carney said solemnly. It's not for sale. It won't be for sale ever. Never say never, Mr. Trump replied. But the moment's potency had been diffused, and Mr. Trump clearly was not interested in having a fight with Mr. Carney, whom he praised for his stunning electoral victory just a few days ago. The relationship between the neighbors, allies, and top trading partners has been at a historic low since Mr. Trump's re-election because of the decision to impose tariffs on Canadian goods and his
and his constant refrain that he wants to make Canada part of the United States. Less than an hour before Mr. Carney arrived at the White House, Mr. Trump unloaded on Canada in a bellicose post on Truth Social, repeating his frequent criticisms that the country was too dependent on the United States of America. "We don't need anything," shouty caps, "they have, other than their friendship, which hopefully we will always maintain," Mr. Trump wrote. "They, on the other hand, need everything," shouty cap, "from us." Mr. Trump struck a much more conciliatory tone in the one-on-one meeting. He did not mention that Mr. Carney had won on an anti-Trump platform, but did refer to it as one of the greatest comebacks in the history of politics. "We have some tough points to go over, and that will be fine," Trump said. After the leaders concluded their working lunch, Mr. Trump sounded positively charmed by the Canadian leader calling him a terrific guy. "It went very well. No, we have a great meeting. No tension at all," the president told reporters. As the public portion of the meeting came to a close, Mr. Trump contrasted the visit with a disastrous one that Mr. Carney took pains not to replicate, the Oval Office meeting in February between Mr. Trump and Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine. "We had another little blow-up with somebody else," Mr. Trump said. "That was much different. This is very friendly conversation." My favorite part is was about the president's use that it doesn't make sense that Canada is not a part of the United States, because if you took a ruler and you put it over the top of the country and you drew a line, it would be straight, and nobody knows why that is, he said. But there's no reason for that imaginary line to be there.
You know, I'm absolutely in agreement. So, for example, I think it'd be really great if we took New England, upstate New York, Washington State, Oregon, upstate
Canada?
California,
yeah.
And we all secede up to Canada. I mean, we'd suddenly have national health. We the roundtable show would be talking about the good things going on in our
country. We'd have to learn French, maybe.
It's a downside. Some. They still speak it. No, I'm only half joking. I mean, you know, the only good thing about Canada becoming a U.S. state would be that their electoral politics would certainly make it so that the MAGA people would not win every election.
Actually, I've heard that a lot, and I looked into that. It's not true. There's actually, if you look at Canada,
look at the numbers.
Carney's gained in a the Liberals recovered by about 29 points in the polls because they were at a nadir in the wake of Trudeau. But if you actually look election to election, the switches within the different ridings or districts in Canada mirror that of the United States, in that working class and immigrant communities are going conservative. So Carney won by a small margin. He won because he was on the anti-Trump rocket ship that was Canada. But Canada has the same shifts in electoral politics towards the conservatives, which unfortunately is likely to limit what Carney can do politically within Canada. I say unfortunately because I am all for intelligent bankers named Mark being successful. and I think Carney's a real pro. I also just want to highlight what a fool Donald Trump is to continue to hearken back to his berating, his and Vance's berating of Zelensky. Why do I say that? There was a Chinese minister who put out a post that said the United States is in the middle of a hurricane. We're in the eye of a hurricane. You saw all the market disruption that took place when Trump announced Liberation Day. Things have calmed down. But it takes 3 to 4 weeks for the container ships from China to now not reach U.S. shores or reach U.S. shores with incredibly expensive goods that we all are used to. And China's got us in a vice.
Yeah.
Because she is not going to walk in to the Oval Office and do a man-on-man negotiations with Trump. no Chinese foreign official who wants to stay alive would put Xi into that position. They, as a matter of fact, said eventually the two of them will have to agree on something, but we are thousands of miles away. So they are going to drag their feet. They've got Donald Trump in a vice for when it is that the shelves start to become bare and goods start to become difficult. And the U.S. electorate is going to hew and cry about it. And the Chinese, I mean, Xi has been quoted as saying that his people need to be prepared. He said this about other economic difficulties, need to be prepared to eat hardship. That wasn't the exact translation, but that's the approximate translation. Now, Donald Trump talked about, you know, $30 versus $2, but he doesn't stand up and say, you people need to get ready to eat hardship. And when Xi says it to his population, he means it and he doesn't care what they say. So Donald Trump and all these antics, he may think he looks like a big man in the Oval Office, but anyone with any foresight would realize that this, you know, what he did to Zelensky, and really he did rough up Carney, only Carney was a pro, so he calmed those waters. I mean, it's really against his and the United States' interest to see that circus that is now the Oval Office.
Calming the waters, I thought, is a good way of putting it. Trump, when using saying the ruler line, when you look at it, somebody drew that line many years ago with, like, a ruler or something, just a straight line right across the top of the country. Trump said, when reporters asked Carney for a response, he quipped, "Well, I'm glad that you couldn't tell what was going through my mind at that time." It's a good way to play it, I think.
I mean, I think that if Carney had an election 5 months ago, he would have lost. And he won because people saw the disruption that was happening with Trump and the tariffs. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how this might actually give Carney a little bit more leeway to pick up the slack of what America is cutting. They're cutting all of this medical research, and Canada is so far saying, hey, we're going to look into funding this, because if you're kicking out scientists, we'll take them. We'll gladly develop the next new big drug. So, you know, I think that it's going to be interesting to follow the yin and yang of what's going to happen with Canada versus the United States, and where it's going to actually strengthen Canada that they get to have the exact opposite response to Trump.
We are seeing that brain drain, because Canada has some of the top schools. Mm-hmm. If you look at the ratings of the top 100 or 200 schools in the world, right, some of the top Canadian schools are way up there. Foreign students who used to come do graduate studies in the U.S. are now doing those graduate studies in Canada. I just remind people that almost every one of the largest corporations in America that formed around the tech industry included immigrants who were here legally for education and then stayed on to start companies or to join companies. If you look at the roster of the most important people in technology, many of the names are Indian. Mm-hmm. Indian students are now choosing Canada. And where do you think they're going to start their companies? They're not going to move down to the U.S. with no visa and try to start a company.
By the way, I want to highlight another big consequence of what Trump is doing. And down in Australia, you saw the Prime Minister, Albert Albanese, keep his spot, largely because of an anti-Trump movement. In Australia, it's less about trade and more about the U.S. security umbrella. Mm-hmm. And just to bring it back to where we started at the beginning of the day today, you know, Trump made the comment in the Oval Office about Canada enjoying the fact that they've got us as a neighbor and we spend so amply on defense that we would defend them if it came to it. But as a consequence of the U.S. security umbrella around the world, a number of countries have not had to build their own security. And the unfortunate thing is, now that they're thinking about it, countries like Japan and South Korea and even more countries in Europe than just the UK and France, basically they can't spend enough on tanks and warplanes to defend themselves. They're going to have to go all the way to nuclear weapons. And you think about the worry that we have over India and Pakistan and the relatively inexpensive cost that the U.S. has borne to keep the world from proliferating further in terms of nuclear weapons. And now Trump is bend all of that, and people are starting what I believe is an inexorable march towards nuclear proliferation around the world. We will rue the day that we made it hard for immigrants to come to this country as our demographics become ever more difficult internally. And we will also rue the day when we sullied our relationship with our neighbors in terms of trade partners. And we will rue the day when we kicked off what is likely to be another round of nuclear proliferation because we wanted to save a few bucks by and contract our security umbrella for the rest of the free world.
So I just want to go back real quick to something. We'll take a break here in one moment, and then we'll finish up our time together. But the president did speak to NBC's Meet the Press, Kristen Welker, on Sunday. And he talked about Canada and the takeover of Canada. And he said that he would talk to Mark Carney about it. But he also said, and I thought that this was this is the point of what I'm getting at, which is he would not use the military to take over Canada. But he said the same cannot be said about Greenland. And then he went on a long diatribe about Canada and how they don't have anything. We have great lumber. All I have to do is free it up from the environmental lunatics. We don't need anything that they have. We're giving them. I asked Mr. Trudeau, who I call Governor Trudeau, not Prime Minister. I call him Governor. I said, Governor Trudeau, could I ask you one question? Why are we giving you $200 billion? Why are we subsidizing Canada? If Canada was a state, it wouldn't cost us. It would be great. We'll leave it there for a moment. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion talking about Canada and the meeting with Prime Minister Carney yesterday, between Carney and President Trump in the White House in the Oval Office, and Carney saying that Canada is not for sale. Meanwhile, we went into the break talking about Greenland and the president saying in his interview with Kristen Welker on Sunday for Meet the Press that while he would not use military force to take over Canada as a state, the same would not be true for Greenland. Meanwhile, there is a story in this morning's Wall Street Journal that the U.S. is stepping up its intelligence gathering efforts regarding Greenland, drawing America's spying apparatus into President Trump's campaign to take over the island, according to people familiar with their effort. Several high-ranking officials under Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard issued a collection emphasis message to intelligence agency heads last week. They were directed to learn more about Greenland's independence movement and attitudes on American resource extraction on the island. The classified message asked agencies, whose tools include surveillance satellites, communication intercepts, and spies on the ground, to identify people in Greenland and Denmark who support U.S. objectives for the island. The directive is one of the first concrete steps that Trump's administration has taken towards fulfilling the president's often stated desire to acquire Greenland. A collection emphasis message helps set intelligence agency priorities, directing resources and attention to high-interest targets. The Greenland order, which went to agencies including the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Security Agency, underscores the administration's apparent commitment to seeking control of the self-governing island. It forms part of the Kingdom of Denmark, a North Atlantic Treaty Organization member and a decades-long ally.
So I'll tell you, when I read the foreign press, they are far more wary of the reality of Trump's intentions towards Greenland, the Panama Canal, and Canada than I have been. I've always chalked it up to yet another fever dream. And it really, whether I'm right or they're right, ultimately, obviously, there's a lot of significance to that. But even if we never, you know, pulled the trigger, still, you know, what we have done to degrade our relationships internationally here is just amazing. And it's particularly sad, given whether it be Canada or Denmark and Greenland. We can accomplish. No one in the Trump administration has articulated what objective we have that we can accomplish with bilateral agreements and just being a good partner, and in Canada's case, being a good neighbor. If you look at our relationship with Canada, historically, it's the main feature of it has been tedium, frankly. And we could have continued that if Trump wanted to tweak trade agreements to his liking in a more traditional way. I honestly believe he could have gotten most of what he wanted, but instead we've resorted to this, which is going to have far-reaching and unfortunate consequences for Canadians and Americans.
I think that he really wants to be seen as a powerful ruler and wants to acquire more land and expand the empire. And I think that he sees Greenland, which has a population of 72,000 people, as a more reasonable target than Canada, who shares our entire border and has a far larger population. I think he's underestimating that Europe is not going to let this happen. This is, you know, they already don't trust us, as you said, Mark, and this is just going to further degrade and could cause a global conflict. So I really hope that the fever dream ends and that nothing happens.
Well, you know, and again, we're seeing the same thing that happened in Canada is now happening. So there was an independence movement in Greenland that was growing to make Greenland independent of Denmark. That has gone down to the leader of that movement went to Denmark to meet with their rulership and said, hey, we love you guys. And, you know, they came up with an agreement where Denmark will be putting more investment into Greenland, where they will be doing it. So if nothing else, what Trump has done is he's strengthened Greenland's agreement with Denmark, which, of course, would make it much more interesting if the U.S. tried to do anything.
Well, there was a somewhat tongue-in-cheek discussion of this, that if you were Donald Trump and you really wanted Greenland, the smart way to do it would be, frankly, to go up there. Greenland had the autonomy to separate itself from Denmark. It could then turn around and join whatever country it wanted, theoretically. You could have offered to make everyone in Greenland a millionaire a number of times over and paid for that, by the way, with their mineral and other natural resource wealth, and made the argument that for the Greenlanders to hope that someday that works out right over decades or generations under the auspices of any government is somewhat tricky, but a cash in hand would be a better deal. So even if you were Donald Trump and you wanted Greenland and you thought there was a small chance you could see your way through, I don't think Denmark would have ever let that happen, by the way. But if you thought you had a shot, even you picked the wrong way to do it, all this bluster and military threat. I mean, what are we going to do? Start shooting some people in Greenland and then face off in a military conflict against NATO? Good luck.
One totally way insane. Or the other, we're going to get it, says the President of the United States. So we will stay tuned to all of this.
Can I say one thing? The sad thing is if America keeps going the way Donald Trump wants, you know what's going to happen? Somebody is going to get us. We're going to run into the arms of Canada or Denmark willingly.
Interesting. Yeah.
Some of us. The blue state. Well, again, the blue states becoming part of Canada is an awfully interesting model compared. I'd like the red states.
I just mean if his rule were indefinite, eventually we'll be secured.
We're going to go to somebody. Somebody else is going to come after us. Yeah. Okay, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Mark Whitman, Anna Markowitz, and Jim Henler. My thanks to all of you for being with us. A reminder, you can help us as we have Listener Appreciation Week, and we thank you for being our listener, and we thank you for being a part of what we do here And we need your help. We need your support as we go through this very delicate time right now, looking at funding. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. We will continue with our third hour of the roundtable after this short break.